listeners, good to have you with us today. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is our third part in our mini-series that we are doing together with our guest Michael Tesarion. The second segment, our last program, we left off talking briefly about something called the Mysterium, the philosophical aspect, both to tyranny and control in regards to Michael's research, and this is what we're going to go into in detail about in today's program. I, of course, urge you to go into our archive, listen to part 1 and 2 of this miniseries to get the full background. And as you probably know, Michael's website is michaeltesarion.com. That's Michael, T-S-A-R-I-O-N.com. And again, just to mention this, that his research is extensive and goes into many different areas, and I suggest you use his site as a portal to go to the individual sites to find out more about his work. So with that, welcome back to Red Ice Radio again, Michael.
Thanks, Henrik. Nice to be on.
You know, last show you brought up Walden 2 by B.F. Skinner, and you highlighted these very interesting quotes that you sent me. One was from B.F. Skinner himself that kind of reveals his, mentality regarding mankind, control as well, and basically how mankind is supposed to survive the future and whatnot. The other one was from J.B. Watson, who was an advisor to the advertising industry and an associate to Skinner. And he wrote the following: its theoretical goal is the prediction and control of behavior. The behaviorists in this effort to get a unitary scheme of animal response recognize no individual line between man and brute. That's kind of revealing in regards to his relationship basically to man as well. And again, just to emphasize, he had a background in the advertising industry. And again, the second quote that you found, Michael, from B.F. Skinner, maybe you can read that for us and this reveals some of his mentality as well.
Yeah, because it turned out that he also was had written a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Kind of a worrisome title right there, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, but the line that corresponds is, quote, in this chapter, or actually this may be it's partly a commentary on the book, and it's partly his quote. It says, in this chapter, Skinner argues that a technology of behavior is possible, and that it can be used to help solve currently pressing human situations such as overpopulation and warfare. And the quote from Skinner is, almost all major problems involve human behavior, and they cannot be solved by physical or biological technology alone. What is needed is a technology of human behavior.
Mm, wow. How about that? Maybe, again, you can just mention, what is the relationship between J.B. Watson and Skinner? Were they working together, or what was the deal there?
Yeah, they were famous. They were famous behaviorists. These are a school of ideology, basically, that started with Ivan Pavlov over in Russia, and again, based on much more shadowy figures that in the last show, you know, indicated that people should check on into that, because again, media likes to put these people in front of us as just solo scientists, in the same way that the Microsoft people were put in front of us, or Hewlett Packard were put in front of us as just, you know, Birkenstock wearing garage geeks, you know, and so forth. And these, and then we think no more of it, you know, but these people were putting into plan. They were just instruments putting into plan a very powerful socialistic. Socialism is not just about sociology, it's about technology. It's about viewing man as having no consciousness at all, in the way that we described that Hegel had, in my opinion, quite rightly surmised philosophically, and that man has no real individual consciousness, you know, therefore should be considered a social entity, that his rights will be delivered to him by the state, and that we, the state, can also decide what is the true function of a man. It's not going to be the function that Plato and Aristotle and other philosophers theorized, whether you agree with them or you don't. But these particular positivistic, materialistic, behaviorist philosophers believe that, look, you know, the state will decide.
Yeah.
If you're just, if you, you know, we have a debt, we have a civilization to build, we have machines to run, we have factories to operate, you know, so get on with it. We will decide what you do, and how much even free, so-called free time you have. We will decide on this. We know how much food you should have. We know what ingredients it should have so that you don't get angry and you don't get malnutrited. You know, we know how much sex you should have, how much TV, circuses, and bread, circuses. We'll decide all of this, and because we know what's right for you.
Yeah. Exactly.
And, and just like we emphasized so much in the last show, which is why we did this in three parts, is to show that, look, once you realize that man cannot be forcibly made into a slave, that the entire slavery matrix is based on his complicity to it, because he's the one who signs on the dotted line and goes, yeah, okay, I'll accept your credit money, your funny money, your faux money.
Yeah.
I'll accept all the imported goods and services that you provide. I'll pay for the police. I'll donate half of my earnings to the federal system. You see, I'm for that. I'm good. Yep, let's go ahead. And then we build civilization in this model.
You know, I watched some of the videos that you sent me in regards to legal empowerment, basically from Robert Menard. Very, very interesting, which details in great detail basically how the participatory relationship that we have to this, that we give up our freedom. And I'm actually going to try to link those up on the main website on Redis Creations as well, because those needs to be seen by more people. Really good videos, Michael.
That's they are, and all the other links, really, even the ones we'll do today, emphasize that people need to get hold of this, these facts, because again, what's happening now, as we said last time, a lot of this alternative research material is being co-opted. Will now be spoon-fed to you by certain shows that are going to start popping up, and even movies, and so people can get confused, unless they're really up to speed on some of the stuff. But again, coming even back to Watson and these people, you know that their ideas were vagrant because they were resisted at the time. This book that Watson wrote, for instance, was completely dismissed by intellectuals of his time.
What happened to him?
He had to retire. He became an alcoholic. He became a hermit. Some sort of Looney Tunes that lived on a farm, in the middle of nowhere, and basically drank himself to death, basically. Hmm. And then before he died, he even burned every single one of his notes and all his papers. He destroyed them, which just shows you how much faith ultimately he had. It's that old Woodrow Wilson thing on their deathbed. And the Theodore Herzls on their deathbed, they're moping and crying about how they, how they pushed forward an agenda that was totally dehumanized. Even they couldn't stomach it.
There's several as well. I know, for instance, didn't Nietzsche have a similar thing? He broke down in Turin as well. The idea of the Superman, he couldn't keep it up any longer, so he allegedly went mad right there on the spot when he saw a horse being whipped or something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah, there is that story. Of course, he did go mad, and then his sister completely exploited his image and grew his big mustache out and made him look completely a caricature of who he was. Mm. And she just minted money out of him. I think he lasted for like 16 years after he was basically pronounced insane. And that's a whole separate story there. Of course, since we're doing a show on philosophy today, it's very important to realize that when you're speaking specifically about philosophers, you have to be wary of using words like wrong and right. Every man who thinks about reality is not wrong. You may disagree with what they come up with, or let's say specifically, you may disagree with what's called their moral or social philosophy. But that's your interpretation, just as they had interpretations. When you're dealing in the realm of philosophy, the common or garden criticisms and he's bad, he's good, this is wrong and this is right, have no significance at all, you see. So it's all about examining the world.
So what you're saying in one regard, that the discipline of philosophy have a certain set of rules that it abides to, the same way that the scientific principle is at least supposed to be abiding by certain rules, right?
Yeah, I think so. And not ever to forget that if you're truly an academic philosopher, people need to realize that a single philosopher like a Hegel is actually three men in one. There are three philosophers in one. This has to be thoroughly understood. A philosopher has, by definition, to have what's called a metaphysics, meaning he has to explain the creation and he has to explain God. Then he has what's called an epistemology section of his thought, which is how does man come to know what he knows, in other words, how does man form his ideas, his understanding, and his conceptions? How does the brain work, and how does memory work, and all of that? And then thirdly, he has a moral philosophy, which is how his ideas will then, how he advises man to adopt his metaphysics and epistemology and then apply it into the world. So even when you're dealing with a single philosopher, you could be actually dealing with a philosopher who has a brilliant metaphysics, but a really shady moral philosophy, or quite the reverse. You could have a Nietzsche. Let's take Nietzsche, for example. He has a certain metaphysics, which we all know, that God is dead. There is no meaning in life except what you give it. But his moral philosophy, in my opinion, could be marvelous, which is there should be no government control. Man should just be free to do as he wants to do. So it depends, again, what area of the philosopher you're critiquing. To critique the philosopher as a whole can sometimes be extremely misgiven. For instance, a Hegel could have an incredibly beautiful, elegant beautifully worked out, highly perceptive, metaphysical construct, and even a beautiful idea of metaphysics. This is of epistemology. This is certainly true for Plato and Aristotle. Their epistemologies were just exquisitely worked out. But then in Hegel's case, he have a moral philosophy which is absolutely reprehensible, which is tantamount to the global village. So then again, when a person comes along and wants to critique these guys, they have to make it clear what it is they're critiquing. Are they critiquing their social philosophy, or are they critiquing their metaphysics and so on? They have to be specific about that. And of course, in today's world, nobody's specific about that, because nobody could give a damn about philosophy in general. And even when they have these criticisms against philosophers, they usually are very misapplied. We tried to give one example about Hegel in the previous talk there, that it's not about his dialectic that is really the problem with Hegel. In fact, the dialectic had been created by philosophers even earlier than him. His particular moral philosophy was based on that he believed, and I believe rightly so, that man has no sense of personal uniqueness or identity at all. It's a social persona that he has.
Is this some of the things that you studied? I mean, you told me before that you took philosophy classes in Belfast.
Yeah, it was just... And I think I got it wrong. In the last show, I said it was 1986. It was actually 1998. It was 1988 and 89 for 2 years. On the advice of a friend who had was much more academically brilliant than I am, he's seen me just moping about the house, you know, on the dole and all this kind of crap. You know, so he says, why don't you go down there and sign on? And I had a history of hating academica like you can't even believe. There is no one on earth who hated school more than I did. And it was a very big... decision, and he basically coaxed me to go down. You know, when they sign you up and you can actually go and sit at a cubicle and meet your teacher and have a bit of banter back and forth, you know. And I don't even know what compelled me to go down there. And I met with Alan, who was my teacher at the time, and it kind of clicked. And I felt that I wasn't going after a degree or anything like that, because I knew my limitations. I knew I couldn't get one. I used to suffer from tremendous, examination angst or whatever they want to call it. So I've never done things for reasons like that. I did it because I thought it'd be a great idea to, you know, go down and use the brain, you know what I mean, and drink in some of these heavy philosophies, because my upbringing had always shown me that man is suffering. Man, human race is suffering. Even those with a smile on their face, even those who have a lot of things going for them in life, underneath all of mankind, there is an element of suffering going on.
Yep.
And that is what philosophy is all about, is to explain, you know, what that is. So I went down there in 88 and took those classes. And it was wonderful, you know. I mean, okay, the school was literally crumbling. It was an old building. It was falling down, and there was no heat in the schoolrooms. We were sitting there shivering, sometimes drenched. I mean, literally, myself, I had to walk for 3 miles to get to the place, and sometimes that was through storms and rain, and you'd sit there for hours and soaking wet.
And this is during terrorist attack times as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. In fact, it's interesting you should say that, because to get to the college, where it was about 3 miles away from my house, I had to walk in about 7 o'clock in the morning, and had to walk through an extremely sectarian area, a total IRA enclave. You know, I was constantly being bricked, as we call it in Ireland, being bricked by the muckers, the wee muckers. We'd come out and brick you know?
Okay.
It's a funny thing, because it was sort of it was a little disconcerting to hear philosophy coming from the mouths of these little muckers as they're throwing bricks at you. Yeah, you know, like a... Hey, nigger, hey, kinte, where are you from? Where are you going? Where do you think you're from? Where do you think you're going?
Yeah.
And I felt in my mind would be like, actually, I'm heading down to philosophy class to answer both those questions. Here's your bricks back, you wee bastards, you know.
Oh, God.
Where are you coming from and where are you going, you know, coming out of the mouth of these guys?
Yeah.
It was kind of extraordinary. But, yes, it was during these very troubled times. And there was, again, I had copped out of that. You see, I didn't want to have anything to do with this kind of malarkey in Ireland, so... going to college and hanging out with my friend, we were trying to, you know, educate ourselves in whatever primitive way that we could possibly. And it was just because the teacher was so good. And he told the whole class, you know, because many of the class contained people who were taking seminary degrees, philosophy classes, people who are going to go on and become pastors and priests. And he even told them, as he told us, to leave all your prejudices at the door. You're now in a philosophical mindset, and you know, you have to open your minds accordingly. And, of course, this was really great, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then you took it from there over to the States then, right?
Well, of course, after the class was over, I left that same year. And it was in 89 that I came back to the States and immediately, you know, continued in whatever way I could, just through reading books for about 2 years before things changed and I took a different road of study, which eventually got more into psychology and film history and what have you. Yeah, for the first 2 years, I basically continued those studies as well as I could, especially reading people like Spinoza. And then I took 5 years of just reading Heidegger, particularly his one masterpiece. And I couldn't understand a word of it, you know. But I have this belief, you see, that studying philosophy, even if it's a guy you don't agree with, there's something beautiful about the way that philosophers write. It's just the simple way that they use words, the way that they think about life, whether it's Descartes or Ayn Rand. I express it as like food for the mind. So it's not necessarily that you agree or disagree or even understand what they're saying. There's something enriching and nurturing about just studying logical ideas, people who think about the world and then write it down in a beautifully logical, sometimes even poetic way. This is certainly the case with Martin Heidegger and also even philosophically minded poets like Rainer Maria Rilke, you see in the German Hölderlin, and Novalis and many other people like this. It's a world of its own when you get into it, even if you come out at the end going, you know, look, I don't really agree with this particular person's thought, you know.
Well, you're definitely going to be richer in terms of your vocabulary. You might be able to express things that you, you know, feel or your theories about the world. And again, by getting a counter position to your own view, so to speak, you define yourself more. You define your belief more by reading something you don't agree with. So I think it's a very good thing, actually, always.
Yes, and again, it's good to be challenged. Like in philosophy class, you leave every time the class was over, we left as changed people. When the teacher is telling you there that, look, you know, the reason, say for instance in philosophy, they talk about the reason, and there's even whole groups of philosophers called rationalists. And when you discover that your human reason is that part of you that is meant to monitor all other parts of you so that no one prejudice, no one emotion, no one vagrant aspect of your being can outweigh the other and create a disequilibrium within your own consciousness. The Stoics talked about this. The rationalists did. They were looking for a mean. They were looking for a place in which to view the world in which no particular prejudiced or imbalanced mindset caused you suffering, caused you pain, caused you to see the world with distorted eyes. You know, when you have teachings like that, it really changes you, because you're then going to drop some of these ridiculous social prejudices that you have, and it's a journey towards actual selfhood and how do I see the world as opposed to other people. Things like this are very, very, very important, you know.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about the Mysterium. Give us an overarching image of what you're talking about when you say that.
Well, yeah, the article I wrote is called Disciples of the Mysterium, and that is based on my work on existential psychology, but tying into Martin Heidegger's concepts of being in regards existential philosophy. Normally, philosophers never talk about psychology, and even academically, you're not meant to use anything outside the discipline of philosophy to answer philosophical questions. What this means is that they're mutually exclusive, and if you're talking philosophy, try to answer the questions of life and meaning through philosophical analysis. They don't usually stray over and borrow from psychology. Of course, I think this is a tremendous mistake because I'm a multidisciplinarian and believe that they should. And you will have social commenters like Leonard Schlein and Alan Bloom, who are neither psychologists or philosophers, who have the right, or even Howard Zinn, you see, certain social commenters who have the right to then use to be eclectic and to comment from all things, from psychology and even sociology and philosophy, to analyze the world. But if you're strictly within the philosophical movement, you're not really permitted to do that. However, Otto Rank, Rollo May, and Viktor Frankl, and Eric Fromm, certain neo-Freudians, basically started to alter what Freud had said, and they developed school. It's strictly Otto Rank who did it, created what's called an existential psychological movement. So as you see, the word existentialism comes from philosophy, and psychology is psychological. So they kind of created this bridge between the philosophical world of existentialism and psychology. So under that umbrella, then, you are and somewhat allowed to then fuse the two together. And under that auspices of existential psychology, which is what I'm into, and also the teachings of Martin Heidegger, and through him to earlier teachings like Taoism and Zen, you have then this basically a philosophy that helps to explain the world. more specifically, when you come at it from the existential psychological point of view, the Mysterium is nothing less, as we talked about before, a theory of human neurosis, given that all psychologists must really address themselves to human
neurosis. Is that an unwritten rule, or why is that? Why do they have to address that?
Oh, it's basic. You're not a psychologist if you don't. You're then a sociologist or a philosopher or whatever. Mm. But thinking goes wrong. People have, you know, pathology. There's people do sadistic things. They're masochistic. They have derangements of the mind. Of course, this is well known from even earlier ages. And so the psychologist is meant to address that with a view to healing it. They're healers. They're people who try to look into what causes hysteria or schizophrenia or psychosis or neurosis. And many of the existential philosophers believe that, listen, everybody has this. It's not just a bunch. It's only more pronounced in those who, you know, are more extreme cases who might go and see a psychologist. But the existential psychologists are quite aware that everyone walking around has some sort of dementia, either mini dementia or major dementia. And that can start in the home. Even the way the family unit operates and so forth and so on, why people do the crazy things they do, why soldiers go and join armies, why people, you know, are so violent towards the earth, because also never let us ever doubt that man's greatest violence, the greatest violence that man perpetrates and commits is towards nature. Mm. And so all of this activity is obviously not sane. Man does not operate sanely. His societies are not sane. And so, yes, a psychologist is the one who sort of looks into that on an individual level to find out what are the roots of derangement. It works perfectly with those who have a conspiratorial mindset because, again, the consciousness of human beings is determined largely by the society. This is even agreed by Freud. He believed that the mechanism within our consciousness that he called the superego that conditions our behavior is largely a mouthpiece for the world. First for the parents. The parents are the first imago that a child knows. And then later on, you need to conform to society. And so therefore, a man's identity, both his positive aspects of his identity and his deranged aspects of his identity, are pretty much the products of the world. And of course, the conspiratorialist will say, okay, look, if the world is deranged, if the world is run by psychopaths, it works in reverse. Man himself will then embody those psychopathic tendencies. And this is the whole reason why my work focuses on look at the individual only, because it's inner tyranny that is being projected onto the world, and it's a feedback loop. Mind affects world, world affects mind, and it keeps on going. And if you see things in history getting worse and worse and worse, you're never going to fix it by running out into the political milieu with a hammer and tongs trying to mend it. You must look at what is creating it and originating it, and that inevitably takes you into the realm of psychology and existential psychology in particular, but also certain elements of philosophy. Now, as you say, I've held that back until now because I had to lay the groundwork so that, you know, another perspective, sort of way that this is sidelit, this whole complex, the predicament of mankind, is from a philosophical standpoint. And how it sort of began to take place is after I wrote the Atlantis book. I couldn't do it in the Atlantis book because it would have taken it off in a completely different direction. But after finishing that book, it suddenly dawned on me that why is it then that all academic philosophers, including the earliest ones, never took on board the fact that there was a great cataclysm of Earth that then traumatized or disaffected man's mind? Then you scroll forward to the modern age and you have even great psychologists like Julian Jaynes picking up on this, although he didn't really define what trauma it was. Mm-hmm. He says that the ego, as we know it, has a date of birth, and it comes from a very recent period of time, and describes in his work that the voice of the ego appeared almost like a foreign voice, like an invader. It was a godlike voice that entered into man's mind just before the Homeric period, the period of Homer, and appeared like an alien kind of voice. And to be more specific about it, he claims that what we know is subjectivity. And subjectivity is nothing more than your view, your vision of your own selfhood. Idea, even if it's illusion, later on we'll talk about it being illusionary, but imagine for a moment it's not illusionary. Your own sense of identity, the person you think you are, that the guy down the street, your neighbor, everyone you've lived with has a unique vision of themselves and a vision of their own separate identity. That can be dated basically from the moment that the ego was born. And the psychologists agree. They claim that there's a two things comes into existence, the ego and then a man feeling himself as being a subject, separate. And of course, with this comes many other negatives as well. It's not just a positive thing that gives man something that the animals don't have. Animals don't have that degree of subjectivity, let's say. Although, again, that could be debated, but for argument's sake, the trees don't have it. You know, the nature doesn't appear to have it. The moment that subjectivity comes into the play, you think of yourself as separate and divided from the stuff of nature. Mm. You are mind and it is physical. You know, you are it is matter and you are mental. But in my work, I've always focused on the things that are also negatives of that sense of subjectivity. One of them is extremely important because in philosophy, there's constant debate about what's called the subject-object dichotomy or what's known as the dualism, you know, mind and matter, you know, God and the world. All philosophers have to wrestle with this problem of dualism. Does the world really exist as your senses perceive it, or is it just a conception created in your mind?
Yes.
This is all known as dualism, and we have the links so people can check into this more specifically. But the dualism, the root of dualism, why you see one thing as two things, and as we said, why you have a separate identity of yourself is because of the ego and because of the subjectivity. But the problem is that, and Carl Jung was the one who really pointed this out, he said that, look, the objects of your own unconscious are also considered objects as far as the ego is concerned.
Hmm.
And this has never been brought out sufficiently. Yes, they all know that the ego perceives the physical things of the world, the chairs, the pillows, you know, the couch, the television, the computer. These are considered objects. That's where the word object comes from. It's objectified to you. It's not part of you. It's separate, something separate to you. But the psychologist, like Jung pointed out, that so does the ego perceive aspects of the unconscious. Specifically, the archetypes and other content of the unconscious is considered external to the ego.
Mm.
And this means, of course, that then the ego is threatened by its own, by aspects of the self.
Yeah, exactly.
And because it is threatened on two sides, it's like Samson between two pillars. You have the phenomenon of the world threatening you to destabilize and create trauma. And you have the content of your own unconscious impinging upon the walls and the battlements of the ego. So the ego has been always described as a mass of defenses, as something that is waging a war both externally and internally. And so no understanding of the world at all, and this, by the way, helps to explain the mysterium and why the ego might have, you know, fallen under the power of the mysterium. It has to do partly with this conflict that the ego feels between contents of even its own self or larger self and the content of the world. Because remember, the content of the unconscious is itself created two ways. One is the Freudian way in which things you don't like about yourself get repressed into what he referred to as the unconscious, right? So the unconscious to Freud was a dumping ground of this particular life where things that don't conform and cause you pain, you repress. And the unconscious is also made up of the content of, in the Jungian way, of all mankind. Everyone who's ever lived, repressing. And then genetically, over time, the unconscious, which he referred to as the collective unconscious, is the dumping ground of all mankind's repressions.
Hmm.
And then this unconscious content starts working on the ego. It tries to get in, and it also influences the material world. Because as we said, mind affects world, world affects mind, and so on. And so this content of the unconscious then is seen as external to the ego as the external world also is seen. And this is why the ego has been described as a mass of defenses. And that's why then you can understand that the ego is what it is, hierarchical, organized, orderly, conservative, and so on. It has to be. In many ways, it has to be. You have to understand the nature of why the ego is the way it is. It's because as far as it's concerned, it is surrounded by an ocean of frightening, troublesome data and phenomena that it has to protect itself against.
And in one way, this is what, you know, animals have this too, but in another form. The brain of the animal is simply hardwired to detect danger and to just get out of the way when something is unpleasant. But we are at least given a chance to be somewhat aware of that ahead of time. I mean, we can try to predict the danger and things like that. And the difficulty here is to keep that balance, of course. But, you know, at the same time, it's almost like it's a defense mechanism. It's popped up for a reason in terms of survival. Isn't that right?
That's right. The ego is basically concerned with its own survival in many ways, and that requires it to interact with the world and get savvy and clever about the way the world works so it can do that. But the ego comes from a defensive aspect. It's armored. It's very, very armored. But getting back to the whole point of the earlier philosophers, I believe that philosophy has always been handicapped, you see, because it never took on board this idea that there was a primal trauma. And it's really unbelievable when you actually consider that the father of philosophy, Plato, it was his own father, Solon, who had gone to Egypt and brought back with him the story of the pre-Diluvian civilizations and the Age of Chaos and the fall of Atlantis.
Yeah, exactly.
You see what I'm saying? Here's how these things are connected. My God, how can the... In fact, where is it the first place that we hear about Atlantis?
Well, it is from Plato.
That's it. And what was Plato's day job? He was one of the greatest philosophers of the ancient world.
Yeah.
A man who looked into behavior, looked into the reasons for consciousness and so on. And yet, it's not really until the times of Julian James that anyone has really bothered, you know, thinking about the effects of trauma. So then, in other words, how can you, if you haven't taken on board that consciousness was completely traumatized, how can you miss the fact that it is that traumatized mind that is looking for answers in nature? You see where the paradox becomes?
Yep.
How can you trust a reason that may in its roots be utterly in a state of disequilibrium and basically shell-shocked? How can you then trust any of those mental faculties to have an undistorted view of life? This is the predicament of philosophy. Of course, we didn't see it to today because it's only in recent times that we've even bothered to take the ancient seriously. All the ancient people of the world always insist that man is fallen. Man is lesser now than what he was in the ancient days when he was directly in communion with what is. And they give the term Tao, or they give the term Noumena, or the great mystery, or whatever. Man was originally... directly in rapport with that oracle of intelligence, nature, whatever you want to call it, and they claim, and this is every indigenous people and every ancient culture, talks about how man has fallen from that and has become more and more, you know, spiritually naked as time goes by. Then you move up to today's world, and all academics believe nothing of the kind. They never even address this for the most part, and even philosophers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who did talk about the noble savage and things like that, they were not speaking in the context I'm talking about. They still believed that man was rude and primitive until we have civilization and modernity, you see? So all modern philosophers believe that no, we were primitive and rude and savage, and it's only since the birth of civilization and the domestication of animals and agriculture and what have you, and we're moving ever towards greater heights of understanding about the world and greater sense of personal meaning, greater pluralism, blah, blah, blah. And this is where Heidegger comes in with the bad news. He says that all the philosophers, including Plato and Aristotle, he's a little bit more forgiving to pre-Socratic philosophers, but according to him, from Plato and Aristotle onwards, philosophers have missed the point entirely, and we're not even dealing with the true object of philosophy, which has to do with man's actual existence. Not the thoughts, not the thoughts he has gained through reason about the world. And this is incredibly revolutionary. And that's why Heidegger, as a man, they tried to silence him by labeling him a neo-Nazi, and of course the entire Jewish network of the time, the Frankfurt School, most American psychological schools, and even European schools were run by Jews. And because he allied himself in the early stages with Germany, they used that as the means to drag him down. What they really wanted to do was get rid of his philosophical ideas that completely strike at the roots of all world philosophy. You see? And this is Jesuit-controlled and also very much Lutheran-controlled and even Jewish-controlled. So Heidegger was nobody's pal, let me tell you that. And people need to know that when they, you know, see all the disinformation and so on. But getting back to what he said was that he basically is saying that, look, you exist. Your thoughts don't exist. Because everyone has different thoughts. The thoughts don't exist. They're not hiding behind a tree any more than God is. God is not hiding behind the clouds waiting to be trapped by this Indiana Jones-type guy, you know? He's not hiding in the valleys. He's not hiding in a hut in the woods. All the things that you conceive to explain the world don't actually exist. They're just constructs of your mind. And so the mysterium then is basically my word for that. It's not Heidegger's word, but it's my word for something that's created by the mind that is later believed to be autonomous and distinct from your own mental understanding, you see. And that can be God, it can be heaven, it can be nirvana, it can be peace, a global brotherhood of man, fraternity, utopia, you know, fame, success, higher meaning, any of the things that you hear people bandying about collectively, and some of the, and people are even affected by it individually. Anything, any of these things can never exist. First of all, they don't exist, and secondly, they're just dreamt up by man's mysterium haunted, mysterium possessed mind. They have no validity, and they have nothing to do with existence. And it doesn't matter. Heidegger addressed only the philosophers because he saw them as all being possessed by this. But you can take his theories and apply it to psychologists, to thinkers, to sociologists, to anyone else in the world. You see it even now with the whole climate gate thing going on.
Yeah.
That's a version of the mysterium. You see it in mathematics, Henrik, with people thinking that oneness represents allness. You know how you hear global diversity, one world, one this, one that.
Yeah.
Oneness, by the way, from this philosophical standpoint, is itself a mysterium because there's nothing one in the universe. Nothing outside in the world of the senses, in nature, is one. Nothing. That doesn't mean to say that nothing is unique, that there's nothing out there that's unique. Every snowflake is different and unique. Every leaf is different and unique. Mm. But there's no one snowflake or just one leaf. There's no one raven. There's no one lake. There's no one rain. There's not even one sun, even though you could be deluded to think it is. No, the sun is one of billions of suns. Also, the moon is up there. You know, there are many skies. So there's nothing of oneness. That's an abstraction in the mind, just to illustrate.
So what you're saying is, again, it goes back to it's dualism, where we have a multitude, a diversity of things all around, but they're trying to simplify things by making it all one, or the oneness.
Projecting it onto the world from the mind, even though it doesn't exist, and then believing that it is really there.
Mm.
Sorry
to cut you off. Is that then the construct of the ego? The ego is trying to make it all one. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the ego has to see itself as individualistic. It has a false identity. It has already... Okay, let's look at it this way. Another definition of the mysterium... Of course, in my work I explain that there's many mysteriums. There was the religious theological mysterium involving God and proving God. There's the mysterium of reason, that reason is the end-all of all man's knowledge. It separates him from the animals, and reason can be used to decode everything, so forth and so on. Technology is also a new mysterium, by the way. But do you know what the original mysterium is?
No.
Is man's false concept of his own identity. That is a mysterium. In other words, the ego is the mysterium. Mysterium is ego. Or if people find that hard to understand, let's just imagine that the two things arose at the same time. They both have the same date of birth, meaning that when the ego was created from trauma, the mysterium also rose with it.
It's a kind of a side effect to it, right?
I think of them as one. But if it's convenient for people to think of them as two evil twins, joined at the hip, that it serves the same analogy. And the reason why you can, another way to look at it is this. If you imagine that you have a mask. Remember the movie Vanilla Sky?
Oh, yeah.
Where the handsome protagonist ends up getting deformed and he has to wear a mask?
Yeah.
That is actually a movie about the mysterium. If you watch it, if people go and watch that movie, or even the movie Solaris, there's many others I could mention that deal in these philosophical motifs. But after you've listened to this, viewers have listened to this, maybe go back and watch that movie with the philosophical eyes to see what's being said. The mysterium works precisely like a mask that you don't know is a mask. But a mask has two eyes. Imagine that one eye has a red filter on it and the other eye has a, you know, white or a blue lens or whatever, right? Crystal filter. Mm. And when you have the mask on and you close one eye and look through the mask, you see reality through one colored lens. When you close the other eye and look through the other eye and the mask, which has a lens, you see it with blue. This is why you have a dualism where man cannot resolve whether matter is matter or whether matter is mind. And this is an infected Descartes. And of course, we're leaving people behind here if they're not familiar with philosophy. That's just too bad because there's no way of explaining it more clearly. The philosophers had this problem about whether matter exists or whether mind exists. This is why they cannot resolve it. It's the same thing you find not only in the teachings of Descartes, where he couldn't decide whether the world existed or he existed. It's the same thing you find in what's called the uncertainty principle of quantum science, in which observation changes what you look at.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so think of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle with what I'm going to say next. Man himself is schizoid. Man himself is mysterium possessed. Man himself wears the mask of the mysterium, and he constantly flitting between looking at creation and the meaning of life and reality in, with one eye open and one eye closed.
Mm.
Every time he looks through one eye, he sees the wave. Every time he looks through the other eye, he sees the pulse. When he looks through one eye, he sees the explicate order. When he looks through the other eye, he sees the implicate order. When he looks through one eye, he sees black, he sees white. And the other one, he sees white. With this one, he sees matter. With this one, he sees mind. Until he removes the mask and sees creation, sees reality, sees nature as he actually is meant to see with his own senses, not one that has been superimposed upon his mind, he can never resolve these matters at all. He'll just come up with different versions of the same thing, which is what the quantum scientists did. They thought they were probing into the depth of nature only to come up with the same dichotomy again. The dualism is still stunning them in the face because they're taking themselves with them where they go. As Nietzsche said, the only way for man to see reality as it really is to get man out of the way. Get yourself out of the way, and then you'll see what it is.
Well, exactly. That's a really interesting point. And again, it ties into the whole thing of where, you know, as a background, we talked about the scientific model before and where that stems from, and the origins of that pretty much. And just as you say, it follows all the way up to the current time where kind of science is almost it's forced to go into philosophy in order to understand what it is measuring or finding, basically. It's very, very interesting, you know?
It's called tautology. We can maybe put a link. It's called tautology, tautological. It just keeps going round and round on itself.
Mm.
No matter how man's thinking develops, he inevitably meets the same problems on the road because, as Heidegger said, you're not dealing with the fundamentals. Oh, in fact, your very search for meaning, I've gone so far as to say that your very seeking for meaning pushes away the sought. You're not dealing with the essence of everything. And your false ideas, like we said, the original mysterium is man's corrupted, perverse, false understanding of his own selfhood, of his what he thinks is his own selfhood, which is his ego. It's not his self, which is actually repressed in the unconscious. Because don't forget, we omitted to say one thing about the ancients. If the ancients were right, and man has fallen from a greater sense of wholeness and knowingness and allness, certainly I won't use the word oneness now, I'll use the word allness.
Mm.
If he's fallen away from that, it implies that he once upon a time was connected to it, right?
Yeah, absolutely, of course.
So then the question of life is, my God, not only are we getting further and further away from it, but it implies that once upon a time, hence before the trauma that the Taoists and ancients talk about, we were actually linked to this. And therefore, the question arises as to whether, you know, we are able to, in fact, get back and get reconnected to that. That becomes then the major question of philosophy, which is the question that I believe that Heidegger was asking.
I think that has happened for a reason, too. It has happened because of the process of how we discover ourselves. You know, again, it has to do with the creation of the ego, has to do with the identification of the individual as well, hasn't it? That we've... for whatever reason, from the creation's point of view, have been pushed out in order to understand, to kind of set ourselves aside, to understand what we actually are in. Because if we're trying to observe the universe and get this objective picture of it, we must remove ourselves from it in order to understand it. Isn't that right? Would you agree on that?
That's the subjectivity that most of us have always believed is the thing that defines us from the rest of nature.
Yeah.
However, one of the dark sides of that is what is speciesism, or just plain old fascism again. When man developed this subjectivity, he immediately thought of himself as superior to every other creature on earth.
Mm, yeah.
Which is not found in shamanism. It's not found in ancient druidism. It is not found in animism. Why, in other words, did all the Egyptian gods have animal heads?
Mm.
Because man, before the advent of the ego, before he became a subjective creature, he had what was known as theriomorphism. He was theriomorphic, therio meaning beast, morphic meaning form. He was bestial in form, not as the Christians would look at it as being evil, but he's the voice of all nature, the actual voice, the language of the trees, the language of the animals, their story, their history, you know, the story of the light, the story of the rain, right? People have called this animism, they've called it pantheism, they call it whatever name they want. Man was in harmony directly. His consciousness was nature. His aura was nature, and nature was also his selfhood. There was no difference between a man's self and nature, nor is there now, by the way, nor is there a difference between nature and the self. They're one and the same thing. It's just that the ego and the mysterium stand in the way of this. Because of not understanding this, man is now committing untold violence to not only animals, but to the nature that is his true creator. The problem with the rationalists and the problem with philosophers and the problem with theologians, and it comes from being mysterium possessed, is that all philosophers that Heidegger was condemning, as well as the theologians, and even the atheists in their own way, we might have to explain what I mean by this, they all are looking for what is known as an essence.
Explain.
This is not me saying, this is them saying it. Essence. They're either looking for essence, meaning that they think that there's a consciousness under nature, God's consciousness, or God is the what's called the first cause or the primal mover.
Mm-hmm.
That would be considered an essence. So, in other words, Heidegger is directing people. He says, when you see a swan on a lake, when you see a beam of light in front of you, you are not seeing it. You're thinking, what is the mysterious essence that belies nature?
Yeah.
You look at the mountain and you want to know what makes it tick. And also this kind of mind looks at the human body in the same way. How do I tick? How does the heart work? You know, it's the impulse behind all science. And believe me, science is not what we think it is. Science is one of the most brutal, violent, despicable things on earth. A man who is in touch with his own existence does not become a Robin Oppenheimer, a Leo Szilard, you know, and an Albert Einstein. So these are a criminal syndicate who are themselves are culpable for being off the track of looking at nature the same way, because they're deluded by their own mysterium. But if we just take it in steps for a minute, Heidegger's saying when you look at these things, you're imagining, or you've been taught to imagine, that there's some essence. It's a seek for essences. And it means nothing more than even the dictionary definition of the term, which is that there's something mysterious or hidden, a thought process, a mind, a spiritus, you know, a monad or whatever, or even, like I said, the scientist, an atomic consciousness, you know what I'm saying?
Some weird,
you know, magical sort of thing behind all you see. Heidegger said that existence is essence.
Yeah, exactly. It is what it is in that sense. But
it is what it is.
Again, we are filtering this the creation through our eyes, and in one way, this will later on as well get us into this idea of reality, even as a computer program that you briefly alluded to, because it's all about how do we interpret that kind of flow, the essence itself. But sorry to cut you off. Continue, Michael.
No, you're right. There's now scientists who are wondering whether we're all living in a giant virtual computer program.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, they're correct. We are. And that program is orchestrated by this mysterium. It is literally the mad scientist behind the curtain. And, you know, the work I've done on mysterium is to try and also look at this problem of where did this come from? How did the program get running? And what can you do to turn it off? But the existence is itself. Is the only thing you're looking at. In other words, when you look at nature, you are seeing your creator there. It doesn't have an essence. There it is. But because you're possessed by the mysterium, you project upon nature the ghost in the machine. You see? And this needs to be always borne in mind. So in my writing, I always say that the mysterium is not only responsible for committing untold atrocities towards nature. Man himself is violated and prostituted. He is one of the first victims himself. His own thinking is a victim of the mysterium, because the mysterium always directs thought to where it wants it thought to go. Thought itself is not working, and Heidegger also was pointing this out, that thought itself is vagrant. Thought itself is prostituted by the presence of what I refer to as the mysterium, which he referred to as the inauthentic life, you know, and he referred to the authentic man as das ein, meaning the thing in itself. Being there, the very thing that is right in front of you, is now unseen because you have this plague, this infection in the blood of your mind, so to speak.
One thing that I'm thinking about here as you're mentioning this is that from my point of view at this time, I also consider this to be part of the creation, part of the plan, if you will. And again, it doesn't necessarily mean that I mean that it's a God behind it all, but the nature is creation, and the plan here for our journey, our experience, is that the comet or whatever caused the catastrophe, which consequently created the potentially the ego, as you mentioned before, is part of the creation plan, because we needed to be removed for a certain period of time just in order to understand what we actually are experiencing and then eventually go back towards it again. Do you hold that view too, or do you just consider it to be like it's all a waste, we shouldn't have gone that route to begin with, or do you think that we have learned something because of it? We're obviously not out of it yet, and the question is if we ever will be. But what's your approach to it? What's your relationship with that, Michael?
I believe it has to happen like you do, because also being a Taoist, the Taoist has a policy of non-interference. The Taoist says that nothing is wrong, nothing is right. When you see something going off in what you think is a wrong direction, that is because it is being directed by the Tao to do that.
Yeah.
And it's more elaborate than I can go into, but exactly, they claim that this needs to be because this may be man's route back to the Tao.
Yeah, exactly.
More specifically, more practically, they just say, let man do as he does. Do not interfere with the will of what is, because there is a derangement happening. Don't blame a madman for doing what from doing mad things.
It's a way for us to process the experience and the only way for us to learn and to grow, to be in it and to experience it in this way in order to break free from it if we so choose.
That's right. And remember, they would emphasize that you, first of all, can never direct a man towards the truth or the Tao. You must always only instruct a man to know that he is the truth, and he must look for it himself. The truth is what he makes of his life. There is no truth per se, generally. That's an illusion.
No objective truth, right?
There's no objective truth. There is only man seeking for the truth becomes the truth. Man is the truth and the way. Now, what has happened is, part of the mysterium that man has, because he is an isolated ego, and you see, deep inside the heart of every man, or more specifically, in the unconscious of every man, is his true selfhood. And so for even in the ego, even in the consciousness of man, there is in fact an impulse for true individualism and individuality. True, not just the fake form, you know, that's created by the pseudo-individual, Hegel's social man or whatever. Now, when that impulse of true freedom and individualism starts to awaken, man is instantly thrown into conflict. He's thrown into conflict with the world that has no interest in him being a free individual. And he's thrown into conflict with the rest of his self, which is aligned with the ego and also doesn't want it. So this is where man's present angst comes from. He's in stress inside because he's at war with other aspects of his being that are conformist in form. And he's also at war with the people of the world and the world's consensus, right?
Mm.
But the religions and the scientisms of the world know this. They know that man is seeking for his individualism and that he's never going to have it. So what they do is they create gods and Jesus Christ and these other heroic icons, these pseudo-individuals, so that man will then identify with those forms in order to, you know, appease this sense of individuality that works within his own soul, but that he cannot actually truly attain himself. You know, it's one of these banes that comes with the subjectivity problem.
Exactly.
And therefore, you see, the Taoists would always, to answer your question, the Taoists would say that nothing that goes against nature's ordinances can last forever. Mm. It is only a momentary blip.
Yeah.
All evil, should it even exist, and they did believe it existed, merely carries within it the seed of its own destruction.
Mm. Yeah.
Things rise and they fall. So just give evil a lot of space. Let it do its little thing, but never have any concern at all that it's going to stop the water flowing on the waterfall, the light from shining on the lake. From the breath and the ether being there, you see, they're not interested in that. And the reason why they're not interested in it is because the Taoist has no time for anything that men generate as a collective. They also have nothing to do with man, with anything that is created by the thoughts of men. I know this sounds really weird until you realize what the philosophical premises are underneath all of these theories. Anything that is generated by the mind of man is of secondary or almost no interest to a Taoist, because they're only interested in his existence.
Mm.
They're not interested in their people's image of themselves or what they have then subsequently created in the world based on those images. And they're certainly not interested in anything that civilization or mass movements create, because the Tao sees those as purely momentary aberrations in the flow of reality, you see.
Hmm. It's what a quirk, in a way. Very strange in that sense. What about if we, at the end of this first hour here, Michael, begin to round things up on the note of basically the reality of existence, to go over a few more points on that, basically what role the mind plays in the creation of the world. You mentioned computer program before, either if you want to talk more about that or specifically about what the power of our own imagination, you know, the fact that we seem to create all of this as well, and you alluded to Solaris before as an example of this.
Yes, this is the power of the unconscious. The unconscious comes in very strongly because... As we said, not only does the instinct of true rebellion and true individualism reside within the unconscious of everyone, the Jungian and Freudian definitions of the unconscious, in my opinion, are somewhat flawed. They're largely correct, but there's one thing that they both somewhat lack or didn't emphasize. For Freud and Jung, the unconscious contains repressions, right? The content that you repress.
Yeah.
The only difference between them is that Freud just believed you did it in this life, and Jung said, no, there's a collective one where all mankind has been doing it. However, they didn't emphasize enough something much more interesting, and that is that at the deepest hemispheres of the unconscious is where actually the self exists, the true self, the whole self, not the ego. And it is that self that was once upon a time at the font of all knowledge, like the ancestors were commenting. That self is the self that is nature, is the self, okay? Mm. Like the lemniscate, you know?
Mm.
The figure eight on its side. That self is very deeply in what we call the unconscious. And as we said before on other shows, it's only called unconscious because your ego is the light keeper and just simply won't turn the light on so that you can see the whole of your consciousness, right?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Imagine it like a landscape, almost like a Tolkien-like landscape where you've got a tower on one end of the horizon and another tower on the other horizon, but there's a darkness in between, you know, and you can't see them both.
Mm.
So there's a tower of the self and the tower of the ego, and they're just rivaling the hell out of each other, you know? But deep in the unconscious is this is the self, and that's why psychologists in general try to work with you to bring forth the self. Now, say you were to take a virtual tour of the unconscious. Say I could wave a magic wand and everyone could immediately take in just half an hour a virtual tour of everything that exists within the collective unconscious and take it like a magical ride, you know, all the way from where you are now, all the way through the darkest reservoirs of the underworld, right through the unconscious, right down to its ancestral memories, all the impressions and archetypes and all the ideas, everything that makes up the unconscious, just like going to the moon, you know, like in Solaris, just like going to the planet, or Dune is another movie that also talks about this in a way, the ocean planet, representing the unconscious and the free men being archetypes with the lustrous eyes and all of these kinds of things, you see.
Yeah.
And this endless emphasis on water, which is a Taoist principle, by the way. So imagine that you can take this virtual tour and then you come back. You get off the couch and you say, I've been all the way through the unconscious, right to the very first thought that ever was thought by the first man in the world.
Mm.
If Jung is right that the unconscious is made up of every thought of every man, every experience of motherhood, every experience of fire, every experience of fear, every experience of a mystery, which then later on became the God idea to account for that mystery, every experience of the hunt, every experience of animal, every experience of cold, you see. Imagine you had the chance, like in that movie, also is called, what is it? It's the Ken Russell movie.
Which one is this here?
It's the early one where they go into the big thing, they go into this suspended animation tank, and one of the guys regresses and becomes like an ape.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's called Altered States.
Altered States, right. This is, again, what I'm talking about, that this guy actually started to regress through the limbic areas of his brain and so forth and so on. Well, imagine you could do that in just 2 minutes. According to the Jungian theory, you'd actually step out in the now, Henrik.
Mm.
The deeper you get into the unconscious, the more you return to the present moment. And it's fascinating how that works. If we have a few minutes, I'd like to explain it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Jung said, see, a lot of people thought that Freud and Jung were different because Jung was mystical and Freud was atheistic or practical. This is not true. Jung and Freud were on the same page. Freud said that all human experience is gained in this life. Your mind is blank, and everything that a child knows is learned in this life from experience. A lot of people who haven't read Jung very deeply think he didn't agree with that. Yes, he did. Even though he has his unconscious memory bank, which is the unconscious, the collective unconscious, is bigger than Freud's idea of the unconscious, the very first man who had the very first experience on Earth in order to create any idea at all still learnt it from experience.
Mm-hmm.
So Freud, Jung's idea of experience is just backdated. That's all the difference is. So in other words, if you took this virtual tour of the unconscious to get back to being the first Adam, the first man, whatever way you want to look at it, who had the first scent of a rose, who had the first feeling of water and a river running over his hand, you see, who looked up to the magnitude of the sky, who felt the heat of the sun on his face, who experienced the first color, green or blue or whatever it might have been, you see, who experienced the exhilaration of his legs running. All of these original concepts, which is the content of the unconscious, was learned from experience. So if you were to go right back to thought one, you'd step out of a door back into the world, back into the arms of Mother Nature, which was the first teacher, the first guide. Mm. In other words, it's like the beautiful poem of T.S. Eliot. In the end, right, in our endings is our beginnings, and when we arrive at the end, we return to the place of the beginning and know that place for the first time.
Mm.
This incredible, right. You know, the four quartets that he wrote. It's that kind of idea. So then knowing this, you discover that why then have an unconscious at all if even in the Freudian and the Jungian model and in the Kantian model, because Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, is saying nothing more than Jung said, just in different terminology, then why do you even need the collective unconscious at all or the unconscious at all if it is itself predicated upon direct living experience or existence in the now?
Mm, yeah, creates that shield or sheet between yourself and the experience that you're having in a way.
Right, because remember, as we said, the society is the one that decides what the ego will repress.
Mm.
In other words, it decides what the content of the collective unconscious will be. Not all of it, of course, but the world that you live in and the people that you know, the mothers and fathers, priests and politicians and everything else, is largely responsible for making you repress aspects of your own selfhood into what is known as the unconscious and dumping it there. That content then acts on the world secretly behind your back, and then you interface with the world again. Okay. But because that unconscious content is influencing the world, you're not then seeing the world as Heidegger is asking you to see it and as the Taoists are asking you to see it, which is directly. You're not able to do that because, as you just said, you're projecting the sheet, you're projecting this imago, a very thick one, a very deep conditioned imago of where the world should be, the way other people should be. Then we become our own policemen. Hey, I want you to be like I want you to be.
Yeah.
You can't be yourself. And that person screaming at me, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, you know, you should be this way and you should be this way. No, you should be this way. It's called projection.
Yeah.
And we're also demanding that the world conform in this way. We ask civilizations to conform to this way. So we then, in the Heideggerian terms, have a distorted or broken mirror, or our projector is broken. The program, the distorted program of the Mysterium, is still running, and we can never see the world as it really is. And therefore, anything we build out of that distortion is going to be yet further flawed. It will just rise as a Tower of Babel, only to crash to the ground again.
And it's never been more prominent if we consider what's going on in the world today as well, with all these, again, unification, the homogeneous approach to what reality is. Never mind if the data, even in the scientific model, is skewed or not. This is the reality now, and everyone should abide to it, you know, whatever it is concerned about. Even if it's concerned about everyone should get the vaccine, or everyone now should stop breathing pretty much because of all the carbon that you put out there. You know, it's just incredible. It's almost like it feels a bit just what you said there, Michael. It's like the Tower of Babel comes the highest just before it kind of falls and crashes down in a way, you know, because it's so high and it's built on an unstable foundation, if you know what I mean.
Which goes back to your original point about the Taoists not interfering. They go, we'll see again. You want to head down there? Okay, we'll wait. You'll be back. But anyway, this thing that you're talking about it's no more applicable than today. Maybe in the next section I can address that specifically, though, because there's certain key parts. How much time do we have left in this one, actually?
Well, we have a couple of minutes here, Michael. We should begin to round things up. But is there something you want to leave us with here in the first hour?
Yeah, let's introduce this then. What I'd like to say is that when we know that the Mysterium is operating and we don't see the world or other people or even ourselves, and people can pick which of those three is the worst, right?
Yeah.
It's up to them. But when you know that we're not seeing the world, other people, or ourselves as we really, really are, because it's distorted by this Mysterium that arose at the time of the falling off and the time of the birth of the ego, then we've accounted for the God idea, why man throws up the God. The God is his pseudo-self. It's a pseudo-collective self shared by every single person. But the thing that really leads us into the next half is this. And this accounts for the modern rise of technology and science. And I wouldn't even say science, because I'm not bashing technicalness or science. I'm bashing what's known as scientism. Specifically, scientism is the philosophy that scientists have that only science can understand the meaning of life. Heidegger was against it. The existentialists are against it. I'm against it. Scientism is what we're really critiquing here. But there's one fundamental thing that people need to always remember when it comes to these philosophical questions, and that is, the first tutorial of the Mysterium is this. The Mysterium has convince man that he, remember, it's subconscious. He is the creator of nature and of his own mind. Mm. You have to understand that the mind operates, for all intents and purposes, as if it is the creator of what it sees, of nature, and even of thinking. Well, of course, a little common sense tells you that that is absolutely the opposite. Nature is the creator of not only man himself, but of the mind. Inwardly, in the depths of the ego, the mind understands this. And this is the reason for what is known as the universal antipathy towards nature. Nature is ontologically and metaphysically superior to mind, and mind doesn't like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And so mind has sought to, in a sort of Strangelovian and Frankensteinian way, Dr. Frankensteinian way, to set about to try and humble and subjugate nature, and also to try and find the socket of energy into which nature is plugged, so that it can either unplug nature or at least share in its power. And of course, that it's not visible. Nature is what's called negentropic. It's self-preserving and self-creating, self-preserving, and self-monitoring. Man wants to know the secret of that power, and his technology and his science is, in fact, orchestrated to try and do that, to rival nature. You can't understand what's happening in the world today, or even the rise of philosophy or any of these other materialistic models, until this is understood. And again, it's psychologically based.
All right, Michael, let's round up then on that note and continue talking more about this in our second hour for our members. But please give up your websites again, Michael, for people who are new to your work, and where you recommend them to go in order to pick up more of your material and some of the books and DVDs that you have out there.
Well, sure. Definitely have to head over to michaeltesarian.com. If they click on the next button, it takes them to a secondary pages where all the articles are, and that's where this Disciples of the Mysterium is. This article is, and there's a bunch of other articles there. We also did, we're always updating the forum, so all the interviews we do, right, I mean, right up to the very latest ones, are always posted on the What's New page of the forum, and that's available through the Michael Tesarian website. And then, of course, head over to Architects of Control link there. To look at the DVD you and I did on psychology and conspiracy, which is a first of its kind examination of those two subjects and how they link together. And also we'll be posting upcoming events. This includes talks on other radio shows and also live events will be on the calendar page of the MSAR forum. So those are all available and constantly, you know, updated all the time.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Michael. MichaelTesarian.com is the website. Check out the forum then for the latest editions, and then use the site as a portal. We have links from there to many of his other works. So stay with us, Michael, and we'll be back with more here the second hour. Hour 2 with Michael Tesarian coming up. We begin to discuss the world today, different philosophers and philosophies. And Michael ties things together for us with his Mysterium Thesis and this three-part miniseries. We talk about virtual reality, how to perceive the world, or rather how we perceive the world. We discuss the Cartesian worldview, how we are being shaped by a belief and how that dominates our view of the world, not by objective observation. We discuss how nature creates the mind, anthropomorphism, the shamanic approach, the limited brain and basically existence in its essence and the search for essence. A very interesting hour 2 coming up after this break.